Brian Noonan in for Rokan and Anna DeVellantes on 720 WGN. After 5 o'clock, our old pal Karen Conti is going to join us. We'll talk about 2015's top legal stories, this affluenza punk who's fighting extradition, Bill Cosby, and so much more. And Karen has a very special project that she has created just for the show. So we'll be talking to Karen after 5 o'clock. But right now, I am a big lover of rock and roll. Sam, I know, is a rock and roller from way back. We hear all these stories. There's a lot of myths, a lot of things surrounding rock and roll that makes it all that much more exciting. Our Gary Patterson is the author of Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses, and he joins us now on WGN. Thanks for joining us. I call you Gary. Our Gary, how would you like to be addressed? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Brian. It's great to be with you.
Good to be with you, too. All right, let's start at the beginning, because I think just about anybody who knows rock and roll, knows music, the first myth we ever heard about was Robert Johnson down at the crossroads in Mississippi. Is that the first rock and roll myth?
Well, you know, you'd have to go there because there wasn't rock and roll in 1938. So
right.
What you'd have to do is you'd take a look at Robert Johnson's guitar playing technique, which inspired so many, the great British guitar players like Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Keith Richards, they all listened to Robert Johnson. So I always start there because I think about, his technique really inspired a whole generation in the 60s of the greatest to come rock guitarists. So the idea of selling your soul to the devil at a crossroads, I mean, why crossroads?
Yeah, why?
Well, if you take a look through literature, if you've read Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne, that's where he meets the devil, is at a crossroads. And they used to bury people who committed suicide or people who were murderers, who were executed. They buried them in crossroads so that people could walk over their graves. And the story goes that witches held Sabbaths at crossroads. So it was a place where the devil would obviously hang out. So a lot of the bluesmen believed that if you take your guitar and you set out late at night and you play a few riffs, you would feel a presence walk up behind you, but you would not dare to turn around and look at him. So what you would do, you would just pass your guitar over your shoulder and you would listen to this creature or this, Old Scratch, I guess we'd say in the South.
Sure.
Tune your guitar to a very special tuning, hand it back, and if you took it back, you'd made your pact. You'd be given fame. You'd be given the adoration of many women, but you would live a short life. And if you look through history, Alexander the Great claimed that he was given a choice by Zeus to either have a long life and not know fame or to have a short life and to know fame. So he chose the short life. So you get the idea of dying young. And that's why Robert Johnson died at 27. And it's amazing how many rock stars died at the same age. So it almost makes you think there may have been something otherworldly unleashed at that crossroads, because it's just the strangest thing is more rock stars die at 27 than any other age.
Well, let's get into that, which is something that you bring up in the book, too, the 27 Club. Obviously, 27, you just mentioned, that's when Robert Johnson died, a lot of other.
Mm-hmm.
When did people start noticing, or when did you start noticing that, wow, this is becoming a trend, this 27?
Well, when I wrote my second book, which was called Hellhounds on Their Trail, which I took off a Robert Johnson single, which was Hellhound on My Trail, I thought, as I was looking up some information, I did a chapter on Johnson, and I was interested in Brian Jones and Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison because they all died, tragically. And the one thing I noticed was they were all 27. And I thought, wow, this is rather interesting.
Yeah.
So then I started really doing some research. And I was doing Coast to Coast one night, and a guy who called in was doing a thing in statistics in graduate school, and he said, I just want you to know I ran the ages of all rock stars, from Ritchie Valens, who died at 17 in the plane crash with Buddy Holly,
right,
to everyone, and the number one age that rock stars die is 27, like in your book. So it's odd, because a few years ago I was driving to Florida, and I bet I had 50 phone calls, and it was all about Amy Winehouse.
Yep.
And when she died, she was 27, and they all wanted to know the 27 Club. So I guess that you would say in 1998 is when it started, when I wrote Hellhounds on My Trail. But what a great story, and it's odd and spooky and scary. And you also got some stories, you know, about rock stars who probably were murdered.
At that age?
Unfortunately, and not because they were 27, but they were murdered and they just happened to be 27, like Jimi Hendrix. Have you heard that story?
No, please share it.
Okay, I did a show with Tabby Wright, who was I guess you'd say he started out as a roadie for the Animals, so he knew Chas Chandler.
Okay.
And when Chandler heard Hendrix play, Chandler was a producer, but he really couldn't get a record deal, so they went to Mike Jeffries, who was later to become Hendrix's manager, and you had this great burst of career from Jimi Hendrix, but then he decided to drop Mike Jeffries. And Jeffrey had borrowed over $250,000 to build Electric Ladyland Studios, and he owed some people that would probably, you'd say, were mobsters.
Okay, and people you don't want to owe money to?
No, people you do not want to owe money to. And if Hendrix was leaving him, he'd be stuck with that. But Jimi Hendrix had a $2 million life insurance policy. And I heard this from Tabby Wright. I've got it on tape. He said that Mike Jeffries told him that they murdered Hendrix to make it look like suicide. He was actually waterboarded with wine.
Whoa.
And when I researched the Jimi Hendrix story, the thing that amazed me was that the coroner's report said that there was enough wine in his hair, like a whole wine bottle was in his hair, and that wine was oozing from his lips. But if you look at the toxicology report, he just had enough alcohol in his bloodstream to maybe drink a beer, and yet, you know, all this wine was present.
Gotcha.
So he'd taken 9 sleeping pills. The wine had been poured down his throat, and it was announced that he had asphyxiated. Well, Eric Burdon goes on the radio on the BBC and says, oh, I think Jimmy took his own way out, committed suicide. Well,
right.
That made Jeffrey furious, because if you commit suicide, you don't collect your life insurance policies. So he had told the story, and it makes it even odd. I mean, I guess I'd say odder would be that Jeffrey was supposed to fly back to England from Spain, and he was on this plane, and the plane blew up in midair, and I think they found his watch. And the funny thing is, the more you study it, Mike Jeffrey worked with the MI5 in England, sort of like James Bond,
right,
and was an explosive expert. So there's some people who say that he actually set up this plane explosion to get out of it and collect the money he had on the royalties from the Hendrix estate.
Whoa.
So you look at all that and you're saying, oh my gosh, you know, how could they have missed that? And when I did my book, you know, I had listened to Monica Daneman, who was his girlfriend at the time, and no one had interviewed the ambulance drivers or the doctor. And it turned out that the ambulance driver said that when they got to Hendrix's flat, that he was there by himself and he was dead. That they didn't set him in a position in the ambulance that his head was in the wrong position and he asphyxiated. They said no one was there. He was dead on arrival, and he was dead on arrival in the hospital. She made this whole story up.
Holy smokes.
And then she committed suicide. I mean, it's just so odd. I mean, Devin Wilson, who he had written Dolly Dagger for, I don't think she really was convinced that he had asphyxiated, but a few weeks after his death, she takes a swan dive off the Hotel Chelsea, and she's dead. I don't think Noel Redding ever believed that he committed suicide or that he had died of asphyxiation, so that they believed he was murdered. But, you know, it's just a strange story, and the thing about a great legend is it keeps on going on, and that's what Hendrix has become, and Brian Jones, and, you know, actually I did a show, and we were talking about Janis Joplin, and I got a strange email at my website, and this person said, I was with Janis the night she died. Would you like the real story? Well, I hear this all the time, you know.
Sure.
And I said, sure, tell me the real story. I never heard anything else back. But, you know, the real story is probably what it was.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, whether you find Bobby Fuller's body laying across a seat with gasoline down his throat and badly beaten, and the Hollywood police said that he committed suicide by drinking gasoline, which is impossible.
Right.
It's just so many great stories, you know.
Our Gary Patterson is my guest. He's written Take a Walk on the Dark Side. He's written The Walrus Was Paul, The Great Beetle Death Clues, and Hellhounds on Their Trails. Can you hang on for 1 minute?
Yeah.
Terrific. You can go to rgarypatterson.com, get all the books, do more research. We've got some more fascinating stories that we're going to share. We'll do that on the other side. It's 720 WGN. Oh, yeah, a little Skinner coming back on 720 WGN. And that's fitting because on this New Year's Day, I am talking to R. Gary Patterson. He is the author of a number of books. Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll, Myths, Legends, and Curses. Paul, The Walrus Was Paul was his first book, and that immediately became a huge success with Beatles fans and everybody else. And I appreciate you taking some time on this New Year's Day. The books are fascinating, and the stories are wild. Since we played some Lynyrd Skynyrd coming back, everybody knows that we've got, you know, some fatalities in Lynyrd Skynyrd, but you write about how some of those are very oddly connected to some of the fatalities in another great Southern rock band, the Allman Brothers.
Well, you know, the Allman Brothers, whether they like it or not, actually coined the phrase Southern rock. And when they moved to, Macon, Georgia, and signed with Capricorn Records, they really did most of their money from when they played on the road, because even though their albums were fabulous, they didn't sell that well. So we probably start with Duane Allman. And Duane Allman is considered to be the greatest slide guitar player who ever lived. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just had this incredible technique. And actually, I'm going to date myself here, but I saw the Allman Brothers probably 2 weeks before this happened. But I saw him when I was in college, and they went to Nashville. This was in 1970, and Duane Allman had an overdose of opium, and his fingertips had turned blue, and they rushed him by ambulance to the hospital, and the doctor comes out of the emergency room, and he tells the band, he says, "I just don't think he's going to make it. He's too far gone." Well, Barry Oakley was Duane's best friend, so he rushes out to the parking lot, and he falls on his knees, and he starts to pray. And he's screaming out in his pain and tears, and he's yelling, "God, just give him one more year. Just give him one more year to live. Just one more year. One more year to fill his dreams and play his music." And he was out there for about 20 minutes, and all at once the doctor comes out, and he says, "Look, I don't know how to tell you guys this, but he's going to make it."
Whoa.
So he survived. Now, this was, I believe, October 21st, 1970. And 1 year to the day, Duane Allman was killed in a motorcycle accident. Exactly 1 year to the day that Barry Oakley asked for that one more year.
All right. Some people would say that's just coincidence. I'm going to say it's super freaky. Not to be Rick James on you, but it is super freaky.
I agree with you, Brian. The other thing is that 1 year and 13 days later, Barry Oakley was killed just a few hundred feet from where Duane Allman was in another motorcycle accident. Whoa. Duane Allman was 24 when he died. Barry Oakley was 24 when he died.
Didn't both of them run into the side of another vehicle? I think one of them ran into the side of a bus.
Well, that was Barry Oakley. He smashed right into the side of a bus. He got up. He was walking around. He refused to go to the hospital. And then when he started going into convulsions later that night, they rushed him in and he died while he was in the hospital. Duane hit a truck that had a wrecking ball on the back of it. And when he hit it, the motorcycle flew up in the air and fell down upon him. And even though they rushed him to the hospital, there was not anything they could do. So, you know, you have these two. Now, the odd thing, and I'm still working on this, this is really going to freak you out. When Duane Allman died, they didn't bury him.
What'd they do with him?
Well, they kept him in storage. And when Barry Oakley died, they buried them both together at the same time.
Like somebody knew that Barry was coming soon? That's something you got to keep working on.
The strangest thing. And I've actually asked some people within the band, and they said, "Well, you know, there was some legal issues, you know, but that sounds odd."
Yeah.
How do you keep somebody's body in storage, you know, for a year? And I think his daughter, Duane's daughter, wrote about it in her book that just came out, and maybe last year. But she mentioned that, you know, that he wasn't buried, and they buried them both together. And I think, wow, that is that is just a, you know, strange, strange story, you know, as you do that. So the Allman Brothers sort of lifted this thing. And the other thing is they learned to play the, well, they went to Rose Hill Cemetery at night, this beautiful cemetery in Macon, Georgia, and they'd bring their guitars and they would play in this cemetery and they would write songs that it's going to make them famous. And if you've been to Rose Hill Cemetery, you'll see Little Martha's grave, you'll see Elizabeth Reed's grave. And, you know, that's strange because Robert Johnson, going back to the myth, he claimed that he was taught to play the guitar by the devil in graveyards at night.
Whoa.
So the Allman Brothers loved Robert Johnson, so they followed the little mystique, and then, you know, they had the untimely deaths of what was probably released there, but that was strange. And when Lynyrd Skynyrd came along, they loved the Allman Brothers. And a matter of fact, Freebird was written in honor of Duane Allman.
Okay.
And that's where the song comes in. Yeah. It's where it has the slide guitar part to start it off to the front. So it was in honor of him. And, you know, when you take a look at the plane crash and so many bad things. I mean, they got the plane from Aerosmith, and they leased it, and they flew it, and had engine problem on the way South Carolina to do a show, and
right.
A lot of them had decided they weren't going to be back on the plane. They were going to fly commercial. And one of the background singers, Joe Billingsley, actually called Alan Collins and said, "Look, I had a dream last night. This plane's going to crash. Don't get on the plane." And Cassie Gaines was terrified, so she asked Ronnie Van Zant if it would be all right for her to ride with the roadies in an equipment truck all the way to Louisiana to their next show. And he told her, he said, "Cassie, when your time's up, it's up. It doesn't matter where you are." And Whoa. He convinced her to get on the plane. And when they got on the plane, you know, of course she was killed, Ronnie Van Zant was killed, and as you look, Steve Gaines was killed, their manager was killed, and, you know, it was a terrible end to an up-and-coming band because they sort of went down a little on their album releases, but when Street Survivors came out, it was a great album. And if you remember the album, they're standing there.
Yeah, in front of flames.
Oh, yeah. Steve Gaines has got his eyes closed and there's flames, you know, just engulfing him. And it really was bad for the family. So they did the black album cover. And they did that. And, you know, sometimes you talk about obsessed fans. Did you know that someone tried to steal Ronnie Van Zant's body in Jacksonville, Florida, in a cemetery?
I did not know that. People are nuts.
They are, and it's even worse because they had broken into the cemetery in Jacksonville, Florida, and they had opened up Stephen Gaines' grave, and they didn't get to the coffin. He was cremated, and they spilled some of his ashes, but they had pulled out Ronnie's coffin. So they had to take his body and rebury him in another cemetery and put concrete on top of it to keep people from getting there. Now, here's another urban legend. Why did they do it? And the answer was, it was a bet to see if he was buried wearing his Neil Young T-shirt.
Oh, jeez.
Now, is that not ghoulish?
That is very ghoulish. Sam, you had a quick question?
Yeah, Gary, you brought up great albums. Can you settle this debate for me? You can be the moderator if you so choose. Led Zeppelin had 9 studio albums, and I got into almost a knockdown, drag-out brawl over which one was the best album. I'll take Led Zeppelin 2 8 days of the week. I get Whole Lot of Love, The Lemon Song, Heartbreaker, Ramble On, Bring It On Home. Do you have a favorite Led Zeppelin studio album?
Oh, my gosh. You know what I want to say? It's between 2 and 4.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, you're half right.
There he goes. Well, then, listen.
And, you know, now I love the first album, you know. I mean, when I heard the first Zeppelin album, it was amazing. And it changed everything because you had, you know, Plant's voice and Jimmy Page's guitar playing. And Led Zeppelin 2 came out was fab. It was probably the best really British rock album I'd ever heard. And Whole Lot of Love. I mean, my gosh, you know. And it was just incredible, that album. And I had to listen to Led Zeppelin 4 for a while, but I got to tell you, when I listen to Four Sticks, I get the eeriest feeling on that song. I don't know. It just like it sort of takes you somewhere else.
Well, we could spend a whole hour just talking about Led Zeppelin. Unfortunately, our time is short, but We got to talk again. People need to go to rgarypatterson.com or follow you on Facebook at r.gary.patterson and go get the books. Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses, The Walrus Was Paul, and Hellhounds on Their Trail, all the books by R. Gary Patterson. This is fascinating stuff. Thank you for taking time on New Year's Day. We'll talk again really soon.
Oh, Brian, looking forward to it. Next time we'll talk about Beleskin house burning.
Sounds good. Thanks, Gary. Happy New Year.
Take care.
Take care. It's R. Gary Patterson. rgarypatterson.com is the website, and R. Gary Patterson on Facebook. Go and pick these up. The stories are fascinating. If you are a rock and roll fan at all, you're, you know, the hair will stand up on the back of your neck.